This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dean Borg, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. And during the next half hour, we're going to be talking with Washington Post syndicated columnist E.J. Dionne. And his voice, already familiar to Noah, as a regular contributor to NPR's All Things Considered on Friday afternoons each week. Hello, E.J.
Oh, it's great to be with you. And I just want to say, at the risk of sounding like a pandering politician, that I could practically be a citizen of Iowa. I've spent so much time there over the years, from Keosauqua to Pella to Des Moines to Dubuque. So it's really, really good to be with you. It's one of the most civic places I have ever been.
Well, that's good to know. And it's also, you're using names there that some people who aren't familiar with Iowa don't pronounce correctly. So I know you have validity in what you say, that you know Iowa well.
Keosauqua took me a while to learn, I confess. I think I got it right, didn't I?
Maquoketa is another one.
Yes, indeed.
You have a new book out. I want to say that your most recent book is the Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. Scheinman and Suster publishes that book, and you say if you want to know why we are so divided as a country, this is the book to read. In fact, that's what Simon and Schuster says in the Leaf. That's promising insight that's very tempting, and we have an opportunity right now to tap into that insight. And I want to go right away, AJ, to the uncompromising partisan division displaying prominently in appointing a new U.S. Supreme Court justice to replace the late Antonin Scalia. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, a longtime senator, 30 years in the Senate, is really at the focal point, you might say, right now. And over the weekend, Senator Grassley told Iowa Republicans here in their conventions that his reelection is being severely challenged. How are you, EJ, as you look over the landscape and your familiarity with Iowa, which you've already said, how are you viewing Grassley's political health?
Well, whenever I talk about Merrick Garland, I always feel obligated to say that I have known him for more than 40 years. We went to college together, and he is one of the most decent, generous people I know. And that is actually one of the problems for Republicans, because a lot of Republicans in the Senate, some publicly, some quietly, have said much the same thing about Chuck Grassley. And you know, Senator Orrin Hatch notably so said that, well, if President Obama gave us Merrick Garland, we could vote for him right away, but he won't do that. And then he did. I think the problem for a lot of Republicans, including Senator Grassley, is that a very significant wing of the Republican Party on the right, the wing of the Republican Party that has become stronger over the last 20 years, is absolutely determined to block President Obama from naming anyone to the court, even a liberal as moderate as Merrick Garland. And so Senator Grassley, I'm sure, is thinking about that part of the party in a state where Ted Cruz came in first and Donald Trump came in second in the caucuses. And so I think that's part of the calculation of a lot of the Republicans. And the other factor here is that the Supreme Court has been playing an even more important role in our politics lately than it has at other moments, because there has been what I would see as a kind of conservative activism. You know, the two sort of poster children decisions of that for me are the Citizens United decision opening the doors to all kinds of big money in politics and the decision throwing out the Voting Rights Act. And even if Merrick Garland were a very moderate judge, which I think he would be, he would tip the balance of the court, and Republicans want to roll the dice and hope they win the presidential election so they get that fifth vote.
What and you say roll the dice. How dicey is it for Republicans? That is, depending on how the presidential election goes, they could be really between a rock and a hard place.
Well, there is a popular theory in Washington that if Hillary Clinton won the election, or for that matter, perhaps even if Donald Trump won the election, because no one knows exactly what kind of justices he would appoint. He says he'll tell us, before he's elected. But let's assume Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders win the election. The Republicans could confirm Merrick Garland in the lame duck session after the election, figuring he's better than we might get from their point of view than a more liberal judge who might be appointed by the new president. Mm-hmm. So that I think if he gets confirmed, it will be that way. But a lot of Republicans are denying, no, we don't have a plan to do that.
Senator Grassley argues, and most recently in a newspaper op-ed piece in the Des Moines Register over the weekend, that one vacant seat is not incapacitating the U.S. Supreme Court. He argues that historically the court has functioned with fewer than nine judges. Now, is that logic likely to sufficiently deflect well-financed pressure? And I want also to go into, in a later question, what do you think about the well-financed pressure to take Grassley out this election cycle?
Well, just on the first question, I do think that the court will be more of a voting issue, if I can put it this way, for non-conservatives than it's been in the past. If you look historically, most voters don't vote for president on the basis of whom the president is going to appoint to the Supreme Court. But the voters who have voted on that issue tend to be conservatives, particularly pro-lifers who are still upset by the Roe v. Wade decision all these years later. I think now you have so many issues before the court that agitate liberals. I already mentioned Citizens United and voting rights. The environment is another issue with the court potentially throwing out President Obama's actions on climate change. You can go down a long list of issues where voters who might not have voted on the court before would vote on the court this time. So I think there's more of a risk to a Republican senator this year on the court issue than there has been in the past. And in terms of the well-financed campaign, we seem to have gotten to the point where court fights always generate these sorts of campaigns. This won't be the first time this happened. And given the potential salience of the issue, I'm not surprised that a lot of groups sympathetic to Merrick Garland or the Democratic Party are fighting on this issue.
Do you think there's any additional risk to Senator Grassley, depending on how the Republican Party decides who'll be nominated to head the ticket in November? Do you think that, you know, if there is an unpopular across the Republican Party, very divided, that if he is running on that November election ballot, which he will be, that the person at the top of the ticket is not going to be popular enough to help carry Grassley? Or do you think that in Iowa, Senator Grassley heads the ticket?
Well, I think that anybody, first of all, anybody more than 1,000 miles away from Iowa who rules out Chuck Grassley's reelection often runs into trouble. So I'm not going to predict this race at all. I do think that it really does look, from my perspective, like he has a race this time that he didn't have before. And, you know, there is a history of people who have served long periods, who were popular for a long time, who at some point just run into trouble toward the end of their term. Joe Biden was elected to the Senate way back in 1972, beating a longstanding Republican incumbent who was actually quite beloved in Delaware. And it was a case where voters said, all right, that's enough. I mean, you saw that in the primary in Indiana when Richard Lugar, a widely respected Republican, lost in the primary. So on the one hand, I don't think you can ever rule out Chuck Grassley's reelection. On the other hand, past performance is not always indicative of a current election campaign, if I can use that phrase.
Yeah. In that book that I referenced earlier, Why the Right Went Wrong, Tracing Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party, that raises the Republican Party's 1964 nomination of Barry Goldwater. Turned out to be a real debacle, don't you think?
Goldwater? Well, it was. I mean, it was particularly, by the way, a debacle in Iowa, where a whole lot of, not only did Goldwater lose the state by a large margin, but a very large group of Republican members of Congress were thrown out in the 1964 election. What I argue about the Goldwater election is that it really was one of the most significant political events of the last century because it fundamentally altered the direction of the Republican Party. First, because Republicans since Goldwater have had to make a series of promises that they couldn't keep to the conservative wing of the party, promising to shrink the size of government. No presidents, Republican presidents since Goldwater, including Ronald Reagan, were able to do that. Government was the same size as a percentage of the economy when Reagan left office as when he took office. Secondly, to reverse the cultural changes that began to take hold in the country in the 1960s, most Americans do not want to reverse those. There's a strong minority that does, but they are not a majority of the country. And of late, the party has talked about changing the ethnic makeup of the country, set in motion by the 1965 Immigration Act. The first line in my book is the history of contemporary American conservatism is a story of disappointment and betrayal. And conservatives have had a betrayal narrative really going back to the Goldwater campaign. But that also, the Goldwater campaign also led to a combination of a purge and a retreat from the Republican Party. A purge because first liberal Republicans, which we used to have a lot of, or quite a few of, and then moderate Republicans are lost in primaries or in some cases in elections. And then secondly, more moderate Republican voters started leaving the party so that Republicans who would have voted for alternative presidential candidates to, say, Donald Trump or Ted Cruz are no longer part of the party in the same numbers, which is why the party has drifted farther and farther to the right over these years. In the book, I argue that Trump is no surprise. I quote Eric Erickson of Red State, a conservative blog, who said that the Republican Party created Donald Trump by making promises they couldn't keep, they didn't keep. And this goes back a long, long way. And so the book I like to think of as a book that really does explain how we got to the point where Donald Trump is the front runner and his main competitor is Ted Cruz, the most conservative alternative.
You know, you're right in how that landslide in 1964, led by Barry Goldwater, ultra-conservative at the top of the ticket there, elected Democrats who had their name on the election ballot only to have a Democratic candidate there. I remember calling some Democratic candidates who had won the night before, the morning after the election. One of them, I was trying to get from him what he planned in his new administration. He said, "Dean, I have no idea. I didn't expect to be elected." do you see their parallels in the current election cycle? Ultra-conservatives flirting with political disaster for the party?
Well, I do, but more importantly, in a way, a lot of Republicans do. There are a lot of Republicans in office who are very afraid of what Donald Trump, certainly, and very likely a Ted Cruz at the top of the ticket, might do to the rest of the party, particularly in highly competitive states such as Iowa or in states where, say, Republicans hold Senate seats where normally the states go Democratic, so that you have Republicans with very vulnerable Senate seats in states like Wisconsin and Illinois and many others, where they are very afraid of what the top of the ticket could do to them. And you've had a situation, there's a paradox in American politics where more people call themselves independent than in the past, and yet there's more straight ticket voting than in the past, where people are quite consistent in their votes for president, for the U.S. Senate, and for Congress, because the parties have sorted themselves out ideologically in a way they weren't ideologically sorted 30 or 40 years ago. So, yes, I think the top of the ticket is a threat. And as I say, the best evidence for that is how many Republicans are petrified of what they are looking at, which is why you have this movement for a brokered or an open convention where some of these Republicans are desperately looking around for alternative candidates who might help them more in a general election.
You brought up the convention. Let's talk about the conventions, the Republican per se right now. What do you see in the upcoming Republican National Convention? We've seen candidates, particularly Donald Trump, already now saying it's crooked, the system's broken, it's rigged against me. Is that sort of rhetoric likely to carry into the convention? And what do you, if you're looking and using past experiences, I mean, back into the 1950s, if wasn't there an Eisenhower-Taft really contentious convention
there? Yes, there was a Donnybrook over convention credentials where Eisenhower won the fight to seat his delegates more sympathetic to him, and that helped secure his nomination. And again, you talk about this tale of disappointment and betrayal among conservatives. For years afterward, conservatives said that Ike had stolen the nomination from Taft. So, yes, you could have that kind of battle, and I think Trump is setting it up. I mean, he's been referring to the fact that in Colorado over the weekend, Ted Cruz won all the delegates, and one of his lieutenants used the very loaded term Gestapo tactics, which I think goes a little far about an open process in Colorado, but it shows the feeling and the feeling they're trying to gin up. And what Ted Cruz and others are saying is, wait a minute, these rules have been on the books for a long time. Donald Trump could have played in this convention just like we did, and the Trump people were very disorganized at that convention. And it'll be interesting to see if Trump has the capacity to reorganize his campaign. There is some evidence that Donald Trump himself never expected to be in the position he is now in. He said some things that suggest that, which means that he has not built a deep campaign infrastructure that allows you to win those fights on the state level. Cruz, on the other hand, ironically, for someone who is so critical of President Obama, I think no one on the Republican side learned more from President Obama's 2008 campaign than Ted Cruz. And a lot of what he is doing in organizing to win caucus states, to target voters very carefully, to be very well organized at conventions, a lot of this comes from Barack Obama's 2008 campaign.
What do you think about Paul Ryan's evolving role in the Republican nomination process? Does he have a role at all? He's proclaiming hands-off, but his timing, for example, in compiling and releasing a Republican Party vision is somewhat curious.
Nobody is quite certain what Paul Ryan is doing. I mean, you know, he says he does not want the nomination. Speaker Paul Ryan also said he didn't want to be Speaker, which makes people think that he is waiting in the wings to do this. There's another line of thinking that Paul Ryan is setting himself up as the savior in 2016 so he can be the savior in 2020, that this is sort of taking a long view, that he would feel he'd be more ready to run in 2020. Nobody, as far as I can tell, knows exactly what Paul Ryan is doing. I have a theory, and a lot of theories, it should be said, have been blown out of the water as this campaign has gone forward, which is that if this convention goes more than two or three ballots, I think all bets are off at that point. And I think that at that point, Republicans in the convention may feel free to look around and say, who is the strongest candidate we can nominate to win the general election? And so I think what you have is a situation where Donald Trump has to win on the first ballot. If he doesn't win, I think Ted Cruz has a shot at winning on the second ballot because he has organized so well that even some of the delegates who will be nominally committed to voting for Trump on the first ballot will actually be Ted Cruz people because of the way the Republican process works, separating the selection of delegates in many states from the vote for president. If Cruz doesn't make it on the second ballot, then I think everything is open. And that's where a Paul Ryan could, or somebody else could step in.
Let's switch to the Hillary Clinton-Bernie Sanders campaign. First of all, Sanders says he still sees, a path to the White House still open. We haven't heard from New York. We haven't heard from California and some other states. Do you think there's a path still open for Bernie Sanders?
I think there there's a very, very, very narrow path. I mean, Hillary Clinton, to her credit, I think, has said, look, I didn't drop out of the race in 2008. I went all the way to the end fighting President Obama, and she won a lot of late primaries. Hillary did against President Obama.
Now, why is she saying that Obama. Now, EJ? Why is she saying that now? Is she saying, Sanders, I admire you for staying in the race with me and pushing me to the end?
Well, no, I think she's saying that because she knows she would look inconsistent if she said, I didn't drop out, but Sanders should. And it's good to see politicians try to be consistent with themselves. I think, secondly, she knows that if she does win the nomination, she is going to need Sanders, and she's particularly going to need Sanders' capacity to turn out younger voters. I mean, Sanders has been beating her among voters under 30 by margins of 4, 5, 6 to 1 in most of these contests. And the Democrats are unusually dependent on the votes of younger Americans. They are a very important part of the Democratic coalition. And it's not that these voters are going to turn around and vote Republican. The question is whether they will turn out to vote at all. So I think she is very aware of that. But to go back to your original question, I think if Hillary Clinton wins New York, and the latest polls show she's ahead, although Sanders has been very good at closing strong in all these races, but if Hillary Clinton wins New York, then I think it is very, very hard to see a path for Sanders. If, for some reason, Sanders wins in New York, then I think a lot of cards are thrown up in the air again, and we are in for a long slog all the way to California. I think Sanders will stay in until the end of the campaign, but I think if she holds on in New York, it'll be very, very hard to turn the tide around.
I don't know that you can really answer, can anybody answer the question that I'm going to have here right now, and that relates to Hillary Clinton and the investigation of her handling of State Department email correspondence. But my question, EJ, is that an imponderable that we can't even project what effect that might have if indeed there might be an indictment down the road during the summer or fall?
I should probably say yes and then leave it there if it is an imponderable.
Yes.
I think you're describing it pretty accurately. Here's what two lines of thought I've heard that make sense to me, and they're somewhat contradictory. On the one hand, a lot of smart lawyers, and not necessarily pro-Hillary lawyers, say that it's very hard to see how they get to an indictment of Hillary Clinton because it's not clear that any of this stuff leaked or that she consciously chose to evade classification on these documents. There's also a big fight over classification. There are plenty of documents that are classified that shouldn't be classified, and some of these were only classified after the fact. So it's very hard to see them get to an indictment. On the other hand, as somebody told me the other day, or a couple of weeks ago, when the FBI invests this much time in an investigation, is it easy for them to say, well, we investigated this and there's nothing there? Is there some obligation? What are they obligated to say about what they found? Do some people want to indict someone at the end of an investigation like this? If you ask me personally, and I should say I'm, people should know as they do, I'm on the liberal side of politics. I'd be very surprised extremely surprised if Hillary Clinton got indicted in this. But there is that open question on the other side.
I want to go to the business that you and I are in now and its role in how this election has been covered. What's your grade on how the media has covered the election campaign up to now? And also comment there on the role of the debates. And I will maybe just color the thinking just a little bit to tell you that to say that the debates, and I can remember back to debates that were very, very stilted, if you will, maybe didn't attract a whole lot of viewers in today's media, television ratings. But it seems that their debates have turned more to showbiz than anything else.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you've got to consider what this race looks like with Donald Trump in it and what it would look like without Donald Trump. And I think almost all the grand statements we make about what a strange year it is are totally related to the presence of Donald Trump and also the way in which the media have dealt with Donald Trump. On the Democratic side, the notion of a more moderate liberal confronting someone to their left is a fairly standard narrative in the Democratic Party. I mean, Bernie Sanders has shown us something, which is that somebody who calls himself a Democratic Socialist can get a lot of votes in the Democratic primary. That is not insignificant. But I think the Democratic race is a fairly standard kind of debate in the Democratic Party. The Republican debate would be a fairly standard debate without Trump. And when you look at the media's role, I like to tell the story of one day I was in the kitchen and I had one of the cable channels on and they were doing a live Trump speech. And I didn't feel like watching that, so I turned to another cable channel and they were doing the same live Trump speech. And I turned to my wife and I said, you know, are we living with Trump state television in this period in our history? I think at the end of the campaign, there really will be a reckoning with why it was that Donald Trump got so much more attention than all of the other Republican candidates and all of the Democratic candidates. And I think a lot of that had to do with ratings and box office. Donald Trump had proven that he was box office with his own television show. There is a kind of crisis in the audience share for all of the news networks. And they have given Trump an extraordinary amount of time. And that also explains, I think, as you were suggesting, why these debates were very different than we've seen in the past, because Trump's presence changed them substantially. There was one debate without Trump, and it looked like a much more conventional discussion of the issues than the ones with Trump in them. You can say that Trump has mobilized new voters into the process. I'm still not 100% sure that's true. I'm anxious to have the political scientists crunch the numbers. I have a suspicion that Trump may have attracted some people who were voters in the general election into the primary process.
And how did, E.J., how did you view the Boston Globe's spoof newspaper about over the weekend, I believe it was, projecting what newspaper headlines might be if Trump were the president?
You know, I think all newspapers and everyone in the media are trying new things, and there clearly is a market for spoofing the news. Saturday Night Live has done it for ages. Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert were brilliant at it. John Oliver on the liberal side does it very well now. The Onion is a wonderful publication that makes fun of the news. So I think a mainstream paper entering those stakes is not surprising. Is kind of entertaining. I guess I am sympathetic to tasteful efforts to get more audience these days, as opposed to untasteful or politically biased efforts. And I'll leave aside the question, because I haven't looked at it carefully, of whether it was loaded politically and whether there's a line of attack on them from that direction.
E.J., we started our conversation with you telling how familiar you are with Iowa, having covered Iowa politics and the caucuses and so on over the years. Does the Iowa caucus future still look the same to you? Are we going to see Iowa again first in the nation with the same importance and prominence and role playing in selecting political nominees?
I think Iowa and New Hampshire are so determined to preserve their role that any effort to change the system will move both states to hold their events a year before they do them now, if that's what it takes to hold their place in the system. I don't see how it can be displaced. I have very ambivalent views about this. On the one side, I think there is a critique that says that Iowa and New Hampshire are not the most representative states in our union, and that we would be better served by a rotating system. On the other hand, as someone who very much enjoys going to Iowa and New Hampshire and likes the idea of a couple of reasonably sized states being at the beginning of the process where candidates have to test themselves before small groups of people, I think that it really is good for democracy. I think the problem with the alternatives that have been proposed, which I think in certain respects are more rational, is that we would turn the whole campaign into a fly from rally to rally, airport to airport proposition. And I do think there is something useful about voters being able to query candidates directly. I suspect that we're going to see the system stay pretty much as it is with Iowa and New Hampshire playing their roles, at least for another several campaign cycles.
Thank you, EJ. I should say that you're going to be back in Iowa. We're going to be seeing you tonight speaking at the Iowa State University Memorial Union. It's the Manat Phelps Lecture Series. Starts at 8 tonight in the Iowa Memorial Union Great Hall on the campus of Iowa State University. Been talking with EJ Dionne, Washington Post syndicated columnist. Thanks a lot, EJ, and we'll see, see you tonight.
It'll be great to come back home to Iowa.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye.